Hello, this is Scott Gillespie, and welcome to the third season of Plants Dig Soil. In this podcast, you will learn how to think critically about regenerative practices as you work to incorporate them into your agricultural, horticultural, and home gardening systems. Dr. Martin Enns was my thesis advisor when I was doing my master's degree at the University of Manitoba. He was always all about natural systems, and so I found it a bit surprising when I read an article about him where he said, "Minimizing tillage is good for soils, but eliminating tillage is not necessary for a healthy soil." Further in the article, a professor at the University of Guelph that I had when I did my undergraduate degree went a step further. Dr. Bill Dean says, "Martin is correct. If you move towards reduced till, no-till system, it doesn't impact total soil organic carbon in a soil profile. There's lots of data to support that," he said. "The data may be transferable to Western Canada as well." If you've been listening to the podcast this summer, you'll notice that this sounds very familiar to the argument about cover crops. I had always thought that the more that you include cover crops in your system, the more organic matter would be produced. However, similar to the emerging studies on tillage, they are showing that cover crops do not impact the net organic matter in the rooting zone. At the surface, there may be more, but when the researchers look at the entire rooting zone, 1 to 2 meters in most cases, the net amount does not change. In fact, cover crops in the long term will actually have less organic matter at lower depths than non-cover cropped land. Please check out episode 19, Carbon in Its Proper Place, if you want to explore this more. To recap, the idea I put forth is that cover crops are putting organic matter in its proper place. The surface layers, that is, the top 15 to 30 centimeters, will have the most favorable temperatures and will have more moisture, as they will always get the rain or irrigation water first. Roots are concentrated here, and so is the soil life, the microbes and the soil fauna. Cover crops pump this to the surface, and that's where they're concentrated. The reason it does not accumulate is that it's being used. Organic matter will build to a certain level, but it is not there to sequester carbon dioxide for us. Carbon is energy. It is constantly being cycled as plants put it down into the soil, and the microbes and the fauna use it for their structures and use it for energy. Putting more carbon into the soil increases the rate of cycling. It does not store it. Every soil and climate has its optimal amount. The biggest drivers for the steady state organic matter in a soil is the texture, the annual rainfall, and the temperature. As an example, a sandy soil in the semi-arid area where I live has a lower potential organic matter steady state than a soil in a more northerly area where there's more water and less heat. If the soil has more clay or silt in it, there's more potential of capturing organic matter. In the short term, we may not see the difference, but over 10,000 years of soil development, the differences become clear. Now to bring tillage into the picture. Earlier this season, in episode 17, The Long View on Regeneration, I talked about the early agricultural pioneers in the place where I live and work, the Canadian prairies. While we tend to think of European settlers as the first farmers, there were farmers in the area well before settlement. I'm still learning about the extent of farming, so the only example I have is of a farmer just south of the Canadian border in the northern Great Plains of the United States in what is now the Dakotas. Buffalo Bird Woman talked about clearing river bottom flats, burning the trees, and tilling the land in preparation for growing crops. She said the first crop was always the best, the second was close to the first crop, and all subsequent crops tended to diminish until the land was left for a few years to rest before resuming farming again. The settlers, like Seeger Wheeler in what is now Saskatchewan, Canada, talked of a similar process. The land needed to be plowed and the grass turned under. A series of tillage vents over the year preceding the start of farming the land helped to release nutrients needed for the crop. From then on, a year of fallow was cycled with a year of farming. Seeger saw the system work for many years and believed it would work indefinitely. He wrote his book a decade before the Dust Bowl of the 1930s showed the fallacy of the system. Unlike the settlers, who had nowhere to go, the indigenous tribes were able to move when the soil could not produce what they wanted it to. A plot of land that had been farmed for generations could be left for centuries to recover and then farmed again. The settlers used up the fertility of the land in a matter of decades and were only saved by the newly available chemical fertilizers. The indigenous had been sustainable for 700 years and were only stopped due to colonial expansion. It seems obvious that tillage destroys organic matter, but when I think about it now, I see that it does not cause the damage in and of itself. Tillage only speeds up the process. The export of nutrients in what is what degrades the organic matter, not the tillage event. If instead of growing a crop and exporting the grain, the land instead had grasses reestablished and buffalo graze it, the organic matter would be restored. In the case of agricultural production, the soil is left without some of the nutrients it had in it. To restore the balance, some of the organic matter needs to be used to release nutrients and energy, or fertilizers need to be imported to replace what is exported. Cycling back to the article that started this conversation, it turns out studies that look at depth and not just at surface layers find the same thing in tillage as in cover crops. The surface layer of no-till fields does indeed tend to have more organic matter. However, when the full profile is looked at, between 1 and 2 meters deep, the net amount of organic matter is the same whether you look at the tilled land or the no-tilled land. I spend a lot of my time thinking about potato production and how it can be brought into alignment with the principles of healthy soil. The toughest principle to follow when growing potatoes, or any other high disturbance crop, is to minimize tillage. By the fact that they grow the edible portion of the plant underground, we need to disturb the soil. Potatoes also make it tough to keep the soil armored, as they need to be planted 15 centimeters below the surface, and they take 3 to 5 weeks to come out of the ground. After harvest, there's also a period of very little soil armor, as they need to be dug out of the ground, and they leave very little residue on the surface. Given this new idea that tillage does not cause organic matter loss, and my idea that cover crops are basically just putting carbon in its proper place, it follows that potatoes are not inherently bad for the soil. Their problem is they disturb this layering of organic matter that protects the surface. The goal, then, is to do what we can to keep as much organic matter in place as possible while growing the potatoes. In the same way that areas that regularly experience hurricanes are better equipped to weather the storm and rebuild, we need to prepare the soil for this extreme tillage event in order that it can come through of it on the other side. Current equipment constrains some practices from coming into be in the potato industry, but there are innovative farmers out there trying to make a change. Chad Berry is a farmer in Manitoba, Canada, that is trying to plant potatoes with the least amount of tillage as possible. Current planters are designed to work in very well tilled soil. He modified his to help him accomplish this goal. To learn more, check out an article on SpudSmart about his experiences last year. Be sure to watch the potato news or search him out on Google to see any updates from this year. An idea that I've had for a few years and was talked about in the first season of this podcast is to relay seed a cover crop between the hills after potatoes are growing. In my experience, these areas tend to get wet, and the plants have a hard time accessing this moisture. If a cereal crop were growing there, it would be ready to take over when the potatoes are harvested. The added benefit might be that the equipment driving over the field will encounter solid ground rather than wet tracks between the hills. Of course, there are two big hurdles to this. First of all, most potatoes are top-killed a few weeks or more before the harvest to help with maturity, skin set, and ease of digging. Traditional top kill products are weak on grasses, so this may mean they survive, and the crop does not. Perhaps we just need to find a species that will have better resistance to the products. Even if you're successful at not killing the relay crop, there's still the digging. I've seen potato harvesters with large metal wheels to push down the inter-row lumps and facilitate only the potato row being dug. It may not work as is, but I think there it shows there's potential. Imagine having a field with green strips after potato digging. You'll still need to get something growing where the potatoes were, but you'll have a head start. Looking back to what makes a healthy soil, and given that tillage may not be as bad for the soil as once thought, what can we do right now to make potato production more in line with soil health principles? Organic matter is always cycling, and tillage helps to speed up this process. The way to counter this, I would argue, is to get ahead of the curve. Going back to the example of the settlers, if you tilled the soil and then established grassland again, it would recover. What if, instead of you supercharge the system ahead of potatoes so that after potatoes, it's back to where it started? There's work in the Pacific Northwest area of the United States that shows that incorporating high amounts of biomass from a green manure gives a temporary boost to the soil's ability to withstand erosion. The reason for this is speculated to be because of the spike in biological activity, as all the fresh residue is chopped and then immediately tilled into the soil. In the long growing season areas of Washington and Oregon, this can be grown after a winter cereal crop. But in most areas of potato production, an entire year would need to be taken out of production for this. The erosion control alone may be tough to justify, but if you add in disease suppression, higher potato production, and or higher quality potatoes, it will likely pay. Using the best species for the job, in this case mustard, is the key in making this work. If you're looking to control a specific disease, you may even need a specific variety of mustard to do this. Let's say you do the work and you have a full season mustard cover crop and you chop and disc it into the soil. You then need to make the rows for potato production for the following year and immediately seed a cover crop on these hills. Yes, you have tilled, but as we've learned, it's not so much the tillage that's unnatural as the fact that we need to be ready to help the microbes recover. They need some new food, and we've provided it. This is not a perfect solution, but as long as the next cover on the soil gets a foothold before the mustard decomposition loses its effectiveness, you'll have your soil armored and held in place. The following spring, you're ready to plant potatoes, but now you have a new problem. You have residue on top of and through the hills. Potato planters are not designed to work with this. This is where new innovations, like Manitoba potato grower Chad Berry, need to be tested. Perhaps using a winter-killed species and a planter that can handle the residue will help to put the potatoes in the ground with minimal disturbance and hold the soil in place. For now, using a power hiller or a hiller that can fluff the soil and allow the planters to do their job is an effective means to get the soil ready. Perhaps not ideal, but until the equipment catches up, this is the best we can do. There's potential at this point of another cover crop to bridge the gap of 3 to 5 weeks that it takes for potatoes to come out of the ground and anchor the hill. Perhaps this is only needed on highly erodible land. Over many cycles of supercharging the system, in potato years and in rotational crops, you may have a soil that is more resilient and can handle this better. After the crop is harvested, we again come up with vulnerable soil. Potatoes leave very little residue, and the digging process again exposes it. As I mentioned earlier in this episode, I have some ideas for relaying a cover crop, but they have limitations to work through first. In the meantime, the best solution that I see is to plant fall rye immediately after harvest, or spread it on top ahead of the harvest and let the diggers plant it. Fall rye has the advantage of germinating in cold temperatures, growing in cold temperatures, surviving the most extreme Canadian winters, and resuming growth in late winter or early spring. It will give the best protection, but one disadvantage to it is controlling it before the next cash crop. In this case, you may want to use a winter-killing spring cereal or a less aggressive winter cereal, such as triticale or wheat. There's a lot to learn yet in the space of tillage, soil health, and potatoes. If you want to dig deeper into this, pun totally intended, I suggest that you check out SpudSmart webinar called Are Cover Crops Worth the Work? I start by presenting the case for cover crops, and Dr. Judith Ramranza follows with results from her studies on potato yield, nitrogen cycling, and chemical and physical changes when using species such as pearl millet, sorghum sedan grass, brown mustard, and mixtures of legumes and grasses. If you're listening to this in the first week of the episode being published, you'll have a chance to see it live by going to the link in the transcript. If you're listening to this after September 9th, 2021, the link should still point you to a way to listen to the replay. If it does not, check future episodes, as I'll be sure to have a link. You can also check the media page on my website for a link to the recording by going to www.plantsdigsoil.com/media. Remember to get local advice before acting upon this information. If you do not know who to talk to, get a hold of me and I'll help you to find someone. If you're in my local area and need help, contact me. It is always free to chat. If we get to the point that the scope broadens to consulting work, we can work out a plan that fits your budget. Would you like to keep up with me through a free monthly newsletter? Go to www.plantsdigsoil.com/contact and select the newsletter option. If you've not subscribed to the podcast yet, please make sure you do in your favorite app. If you're a longtime listener, will you consider leaving me a review? This helps others to discover the podcast. If you know of someone that would enjoy this, please make sure to share it with them directly or through your social networks. If you're still listening, you're probably like me and want to know what the catch is. Why am I putting out this information for free? The reason is that I love to learn and I love to share the information. My knowledge has been built up from experience in my own garden, advising clients in my consulting business, and from reading the latest books and articles on agronomy and regenerative agriculture. I have a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture with an agronomy focus and a Master's of Science with a focus on plant science. Beyond my formal education, I have attained and maintained my Certified Crop Advisor designation and am a member in good standing with the Alberta Institute of Agrologists. Nearly everything I talk about is from free resources posted to university and research organization websites. Books that used to be hard to track down are available to buy or borrow for nearly anyone with an e-reader. The information is out there. Sifting through it all is what takes the time. I make my living entirely from consulting. I do not sell products, software, or systems. I strive to be as independent and as unbiased as possible, so I can provide the best advice to my clients and help as many people as possible move from conventional to regenerative agriculture.